A Day in the Life. It was a writer, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who became the voice of millions of nameless Russians sent to the Soviet gulag. He was permitted to publish a single novel in his home country, A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. It became the story of exile to Siberia, under the bleak, freezing moon, which Solzhenitsyn taught us was the wolf's sun. Prisoners measured life in days survived and crumbs eaten, and learned that when you're cold, don't expect sympathy from someone who is warm. The long life of Alexander Solzhenitsyn on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, August 4th. Also today, closing arguments at Guantanamo Bay have ended, or they actually begin this morning. An historic military trial against Osama bin Laden's former driver will then head to the jury. The suicide of the Army biodefense scientist suspected of the anthrax attacks has triggered new safety questions and foreclosures at record highs, a new strategy to combat family woes. That's coming up this hour, but first, these headlines. Good morning, John.
Dora. Good morning there. Yes, 4 days before the Olympic Games begin in Beijing, Chinese state media say 16 policemen have been killed in an attack in the northwestern region of Xinjiang. The Chinese news agency said two attackers rammed a dump truck at a border police post in Kashgar and threw grenades, causing an explosion. President Bush leaves today for a week-long Asian tour that starts in South Korea and eventually takes him to Beijing. He'll be the first Bush president to attend an Olympics on foreign soil.
Texas emergency management officials are keeping a close watch on a tropical storm headed for the Gulf Coast. Hurricane watches are up as Tropical Storm Edward moves west along the Louisiana coast toward Texas. About 20,000 scientists, government officials, and activists are in Mexico City for a six-day global conference on AIDS. Singer Annie Lennox is an Oxfam ambassador attending the conference.
Without our action, we are really facing the wipeout of so many future generations.
A new study by the Center for Disease Control indicates the U.S. has been underreporting the number of new HIV infections. They're 40% higher than previously estimated.
Government scientists says DNA evidence collected in the 2001 anthrax attacks that led investigators to Bruce Ivins is likely to spark debate in the scientific community. The scientist says investigators were able to link DNA from the victims to a strain of anthrax used in Ivins' lab. Russian media reports say Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has sent condolences upon the death of Nobel Prize-winning author Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Solzhenitsyn's books chronicled the horrors of dictator Joseph Stalin's slave labor camps. More on that coming up in a moment. In politics, John McCain starts in Pennsylvania and then heads to South Dakota for the annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. That's a lot of fun. And Barack Obama unveils an energy plan in Lansing, Michigan.
Oil is at $126 a barrel in Asian trading. The Dow closed down 0.5% to 11,362. The S&P opens at 1260.
Books that changed the world in view of the death of Alexander Solzhenitsyn. There are certain books that did change the world. What's your favorite political book? Thinking of Animal Farm, maybe? George Orwell? There's all kinds of titles there. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's how to reach us.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Alexander Solzhenitsyn has died near Moscow at the age of 89. The Russian writer and dissident, whose works delivered a damning indictment of the communist system, spent years in labor camps before being denounced as a traitor and exiled. He lived for decades in the United States, in Vermont, and the only book that he was permitted to have published in the Soviet Union is One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, and it is a slender volume.
Yeah, it's tiny.
And Alexander Solzhenitsyn is not known for slender volumes, but this one book caused an extraordinary change in Soviet literature and in the sense of confrontation with the Soviet government. Solzhenitsyn was the voice of that confrontation for a very, very long time. Here he is speaking in 1994.
I do not intend to take any post, whether in the government ни по назначению, ни по выборам.
Neither by appointment nor by election.
When the Soviet Union fell, Solzhenitsyn was asked to be in the government. You hear him there refusing. And he maintained throughout his period when he returned to Russia and actually lived there as a critic of the government, that the Soviet Union, that Russia, despite its denunciation of Stalinism, had never approached democracy. We're joined by Archie Barron, whose acclaimed BBC documentary, The Homecoming, followed Solzhenitsyn on his return to Moscow after a 20-year exile living in New England here in the United States. Archie, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Describe the character of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who returned to Russia at a moment when really the sense of him having achieved a certain kind of spiritual victory over the Soviet communism was at its peak.
Well, I think that's right in terms of spiritual victory. What you've got to remember is when he went home, here is a man who was born in 1918, just a few months after the revolution, who lived through the worst excesses of Stalinism, who fought bravely in the Second World War, who was denounced and exiled. And all of that time, he'd said, communism will fall because it's morally corrupt and society will find it unsustainable. And at that time, in the 70s and the 80s, you know, that was a fact of life, that two worlds, East and West, and everyone thought he was mad. He was vindicated. He was right. The communism did implode. So when he went home, he was in many ways a prophet. He had foreseen it, and an awful lot of people expected extraordinary things of him. But he was a man in his mid-late 70s. He was a man who was a writer and not a politician. And he was a man who used the power of the pen and great force of character, but was not going to be a political leader. So his homecoming to a Russia that, though free, was far from a utopia, was always going to be an unusual and difficult one.
How did he view his Nobel Prize? I mean, he, in many ways, it seemed in his speech and in his petitions to the Soviet government that he was more concerned about what communism was doing to the reputation of Russian literature as much as any other critique he had.
Well, what you've got to understand about Russia is that literature is not an add-on. It's not a luxury. It's a sort of thrilling pulse of society. When we were traveling back with Solzhenitsyn, we went from Vladivostok to Moscow, 2 months on the train across Siberia to some of the most remote parts of Siberia. And we turn up in little villages, and there were people who had kept copies of One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, or the huge multi-volume Gulag Archipelago, hidden in Soviet times. They'd been smuggled into them, and they had them for signature. And they came and they asked him questions about literature. And they asked me, as a British filmmaker, they would ask me questions like, what is the state of literature in your country? So the status of literature is huge. And Solzhenitsyn, like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, the real giant, and writers in Russian society were people with enormous moral powers of persuasion, and they had a following that was part political, part spiritual, and moral.
And there really is no successor in Russia right now. Archie Barron, thank you so much for joining us. Archie Barron is a documentary maker who made the award-winning documentary about Solzhenitsyn's return to Russia after 20 years of exile in Vermont. Archie Barron.
A giant who lived a very long time. Gitmo.
As a critic,
yes. As a critic. We're going to move to Gitmo because today closing arguments begin in Guantanamo Bay at the terrorism trial against Leem Hamdan. He's the man known as Osama bin Laden's former driver, and the closing arguments really cap off 2 weeks of testimony in the first war crimes tribunal in the U.S. since World War II, and it's certainly drawn tremendous scrutiny as the judge has questioned whether alleged confessions were coerced. And trial watchers observe a process that came about after the U.S. Supreme Court rebuked prior Bush administration plans for the alleged enemy combatants. Joining us now is U.S. Army Prosecutor Colonel Lawrence J. Morris, the Chief Prosecutor in the Hamdan case. Good morning, Colonel, and many thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Let's start with some of the criticism. I'm sure you've heard all of it. The trial has been called a farce, for starters. How do you respond to some of those criticisms that the method is undemocratic and not in line with our Constitution?
It is a constitutional method. The Constitution provides for trials such as this, and of course it all derives from constitutional authority, from the president's authority, and this particular mechanism was specifically authorized by Congress. But as far as the details, look at, you know, watch the trial, listen to people who have been down there and watched the entire trial, and you are hard-pressed to look at anything in the trial that's different from a conventional trial.
What about
all? We'll stand by what's actually going on in the courtroom. Go ahead, please.
No. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Let's talk about some of the issues that the judge had with the statements, the alleged statements of Salim Hamdan, that there were questions as to whether or not they were coerced, that they were gotten after some kind of torture.
No, there were no questions about torture in this case, but there were concerns, as there are, as you know, in cases tried anywhere in the U.S. at times, about the circumstances under which statements are taken. So you look at all of the circumstances together to determine whether they're reliable enough and whether they're trustworthy enough. So this shows the commitment to due process that we have there. He admitted most of the statements, but he did exclude some of the statements, and we're able to proceed to trial anyway.
Okay, let's talk about Hamdan. He admits that he was a bin Laden driver. What's the strongest evidence that you believe you put on trial showing that Hamdan did conspire and support terrorism as charged?
Anytime somebody joins an organization and takes action in furtherance of that organization's goals, in this case, the goals of Al-Qaeda, then they become a co-conspirator. They're associating themselves with, as he said, with uncontrollable enthusiasm, with the goals of that organization. So we, you know, that business of him being just a driver has never been the government's characterization. He is an Al-Qaeda warrior, and among his functions was driving bin Laden. But he also was a combatant. He was a trusted bodyguard. He was somebody so close to the inside of that organization that he kept the leadership alive so they could carry out their terrorist aims.
Well,
so
Colonel Morris, let's clarify then, because I think Dora's question is to the point here. Say you're talking to someone who observed what happened on 9/11 here in New York and was fearful of what it meant for the future of the United States. What is it that Hamdan is guilty of that should make such a person feel better that they're now in custody? In other words, what is his detention done to make it less likely that that's going to happen to somebody sitting in New York here?
That's a great question. And, you know, you can always get down to isolating one person and say, well, do you drop this one person out and can a criminal organization still persist? And we know from rooting out the mafia and other well-run criminal organizations that it's hard to pluck one person out and say the whole organization will fall. But organizations like that rely on Hamdans to keep them alive, to literally keep the leadership of the organization alive. So if you don't have these enthusiastic people who perform all of the functions that Hamdan performed, including making sure that bin Laden stays alive, that bin Laden is taken to safe places every time that he's on the run, then the whole organization cannot thrive.
Colonel Lawrence J. Morris, we thank you so much for your time today, sir, and certainly hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
Colonel Lawrence J. Morris, he's a U.S. Army prosecutor, the chief prosecutor in the Hamdan trial.
And I think you hear him saying that, you know, they have somebody who was involved in Al-Qaeda, but not a leader.
Well, not only that, but, and this is why we continue these conversations. It's a larger context. Yeah. It's a historic trial, and this is the first person that goes before the military tribunal.
Oh, it's been
worth thinking about. It's worth thinking about.
Good morning, everybody. Nobel Prize-winning author Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who died yesterday, is certainly one of the voices of confrontation with the Soviet Empire, who, in part, brought that empire down. He won the Nobel Prize in 1970. The Soviet Union fell 20 years later. If you know of books or can think of books that had political significance that changed the world, contact us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.com. www.anthrax.org. We shift now to the anthrax case, which blew into the headlines last week with the reported suicide of Bruce E. Ivins, who's a biodefense research expert and scientist who the FBI believes was responsible for the anthrax attacks by mail back in 2001. Reporter Scott Shane is following the story for the New York Times. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
What are we beginning to learn about, first of all, Bruce Ivins, and second of all, the case that the FBI was preparing?
Bruce Ivins was a longtime anthrax researcher at Fort Detrick at the Army's Biodefense Research Center there. And we've learned that he certainly had access to anthrax in the lab, and that the FBI, which has spent nearly 7 years on this case with a lot of false starts and a major false trail leading to another scientist from the same research center, had traced through genetic analysis the powder that was in the envelopes that killed five people back in 2001 to his lab, to Bruce Ivins' lab. But what I have been told is that the case against him was largely circumstantial, and that, for example, they traced the anthrax to the lab, but he was not the only person who had access to that lab or to that supply of anthrax. And I was told yesterday that perhaps 10 people would have had access to that anthrax. Also, I was told that at another key point in the mailing of the letters, they could not link Bruce Ivins to the mailbox in Princeton, New Jersey, the contaminated mailbox that the investigators concluded the letters were mailed from. They couldn't track his car through receipts or other things to Princeton in September and October of 2001. What they have, apparently, is some circumstantial evidence that builds an indirect case against him.
So they have some sort of a theoretical motive, and they have this evidence from a therapist who possibly indicates that Ivins was unstable in some way.
Well, that's right. He, a therapist who had worked with him in group therapy in the months before his death, went to court on July 24th and sought essentially a restraining order against him, saying that he had made threats to her and to others, said that he expected to be indicted for capital murders, referring to the anthrax case, and that he had talked about going out in a blaze of glory and taking other people with him and that sort of thing. Now, I have to say, though, that Dr. Ivins' lawyer and some of his colleagues have said they believe he was innocent and that he had been driven to that to that admittedly disturbed state of mind by being the target of the FBI's very intensive investigation for about a year and a half.
Which brings us back to the sort of original detail. I mean, part of what makes this case so unique is that the uniqueness of the strain of anthrax itself meant only a small number of people could possibly have done this. I mean, the FBI, it seems, was absolutely sure that they had followed the trail to this lab, but there the trail goes cold. So they're determined to figure out who in this lab is maybe the culprit. But from that point on, it becomes circumstantial.
Well, that's right. And we don't know what other evidence they may have. They may have wiretaps. They may have other things that they haven't unveiled. But it's fair to say that the pressure on the FBI this week, as they prepare to reveal the evidence that they had against Ivins, is intense, because just in June, they paid nearly $5 million to Stephen Hatfill, another former researcher from the same Army lab who had been targeted by the FBI. Many investigators believed he was the anthrax mailer, and now they say he was not, and they've paid him a lot of taxpayers' money.
So, Scott, what does this say 7 years later after these attacks? What does this say about the credibility of the FBI's ability to investigate cases of this kind?
Well, the FBI has been criticized along the way for major bungling of this case. Some elementary errors early on, And FBI officials admitted that when they started, they had very little expertise in the area, not surprisingly, of tracing biological terrorism. Now they say they have done a lot of lab work, and they have a much better idea of how to approach a case like this.
Well, many more details to come, and all of them are going to be fascinating. We've got science, we've got the defense labs, and we've got the sort of psychological profile of a fascinating character who, as we know, committed suicide last week. Scott Shane, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Scott Shane, reporter for the New York Times, covering the anthrax case for that newspaper. And now, headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. Coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Tropical weather is headed towards residents along the Gulf of Mexico for the second time in less than a month. Tropical Storm Edward could be near hurricane strength when it hits somewhere in Texas or southwest Louisiana tomorrow. About 20,000 scientists, government officials and activists are in Mexico City for a six-day global conference on AIDS. Former President Bill Clinton will be one of the conference speakers. The themes for this year's gathering include fighting prejudice and using protection against the deadly virus. A small group of protesters have clashed with police near Tiananmen Square in Beijing this morning. The protesters say they were evicted to make way for a strip mall with businesses like Nike, Starbucks and Rolex. Security agents are stationed throughout the city to watch for any more signs of unrest. President Bush is about to start a week-long Asian tour that eventually takes him to the Beijing Olympics. Bush will be the first president to attend an Olympics on foreign soil. And a rescue mission is on at the moment. Helicopters are flying to the world's second highest mountain to attempt the rescue of an Italian climber stranded by an avalanche that left at least nine mountaineers missing, and most of them are actually feared dead. Alan Hinks climbed K2, that's the second highest mountain in the world. This is his advice to the rescuers.
There's no chance of rescue on it. You're in the death zone. Helicopters can't get you. There's no rescue teams. The maximum for a helicopter is about 6,000 metres, and K2 is up there at 8,600 metres. It's up where jumbo jets fly, so you're really up in the higher parts of the Earth's atmosphere when you're climbing mountains like K2 and Everest.
And Alan Hinks actually attempted three times to go up to K2. He said he will never try it again. That rescue attempt is on for that Italian mountaineer. I will keep you posted.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday, and it's August 4th already, if you can believe that. We're going to talk about foreclosures and the home mortgage crisis. Mignon, are you there?
Yes, here.
Tell us, how close were you to foreclosure?
Very, very close.
And are you still tearing your hair out?
Yes.
You still are?
Yes.
Mignon Blanchard is someone whose home is on something called an estate bus tour. There's just growing concern about the housing crisis, facing a new round of foreclosures from prime mortgages given to people with all kinds of good credit. The $300 billion bailout signed by President Bush isn't the only help on the way. Now there's also the estate bus tours. It has started up in states with big problems like Florida, California, and Michigan. Also in New Jersey, where the nonprofit group Brand New Day is loading up buyers on a bus and touring homes on the verge of foreclosure. And Krishna Garlic is also with us. She's the executive director of Brand New Day. And you call this program a win-win.
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, I think it helped us to take an opportunity that could have been a very traumatic crisis for someone like Mignon, a homeowner. And we were able to say, you know, let's save the homeowner from foreclosure. Let's get a new home buyer in that house and make that connection. Obviously, we know it helps the bank and it helps the municipality who partnered with us on this project so that they can also keep this house on the tax roll. So it becomes a win-win for everyone involved.
So Mignon, you're tearing your hair out. Describe the situation you find yourself in right now.
It was difficult. I had some personal problem, and that would lead me, you know, to, you know, fall back with the payment and everything. And I really didn't know what to do, who to turn to. It's Channel 9. I saw a piece of the news, and that's, I take it from there.
And what's happened so far? So you called up, brand new day, and you got your house listed. Anybody come to take a look at it?
Yes, a few people did. At the bus store, a few people was on that bus store that came, and two other persons besides those people.
Now, Krishna, this is really brand new. You just started these estate tours about 2 weeks ago. Tell me, what kind of response have you gotten, both from people who are on the verge of foreclosure as well as those who are interested in buying a home?
Yeah, we actually had a waiting list for the first bus tour. We wanted to keep that, you know, very small and intimate for that first experience. But since, you know, the media coverage, we've gotten a number of phone calls, both from people who are in foreclosure who have decided they want to sell their houses, as well as first-time home buyers who are looking for an opportunity. So we're planning to do another one of these in the fall.
And how does it work?
Basically, we are a HUD-certified counseling agency, so we make sure that we give training to home buyers first to make sure that they're educated buyers. We work with them to do IDA programs, individual development account programs, so that they can save money for down payment. We work on their credit challenges, and then we use a program called Loan Prospector Outreach, which basically is able to tell the homeowner what kind of mortgage they can qualify for. They are pre-qualified to go on the bus tour. We know what they can afford as far as a housing cost, and then we find houses that are within that cost and take them on a tour to these houses. Obviously, we work with the families first, the foreclosure families, to make sure that they are at a point where they're ready to sell, and that there's nothing that we can do to help them to avoid the foreclosure while staying in the house.
And Mignon, so when you heard about this program and you first spoke to them, was it relief? How would you describe it?
Oh, yes. It was a big, big relief because I was really to the point that I really didn't know what to do, you know, who to turn to, what to do. The only thing I could do or to think of is, like, that was my last alternative is to just commit suicide.
So give us the sell on your home. What makes your home special?
I wouldn't say special, but I try to keep it, you know, try to keep it at a minimum and try to do my best, you know, to take care of everything in it so far, and, you know, but just the payment, that's where the problem was.
So, Krishna, at this point, you have no sense of what the timeline might look like. I mean, this is a new venture and trying to match people with problem and then bring in those who may have a solution.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, this bus tour has been happening in other places around the state, and I know you said that during your introduction. And I think one of the things that makes this tour that we've done in New Jersey very different is that this was a nonprofit and a municipality partnering together to change people's lives. You know, not to take away from real estate agents who are trying to, you know, make a dollar, and so they're doing the tours to earn a living. But I just think we had a very different focus. And so one of the things that we heard from a number of people who participated was that they felt very safe, very comfortable. They felt like they had, you know, their counselors there to ask questions. And so from a timeline perspective, I mean, these are very conscientious buyers. Many of them have gone back this weekend to see Mignon's house or some of the other houses that were on the tour. And we believe that there will be purchases that are made as a result of the tour.
Mignon, very quickly, what's your best case scenario here?
Excuse me?
What do you hope for most out of this?
I just hope to for everything really to, you know, to come to an end and, you know, get it off and, you know, get it sell. And that's my most hope because right now I'm still kind of nervous and I'm still worried. So my best hope is to start over. And this time, I would take it in a different way.
Mignon Blanchard, we wish you all the best. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Krishna Garlick, thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Oh, you're welcome.
Krishna Garlick is the executive director of Brand New Day in New Jersey. Now we're going to turn to Femi Oke, and she's going to give us the headlines of the day.
Good morning. 21 minutes to the hour. Tropical storm Edward is churning west through the Gulf of Mexico. It's expected to make landfall tomorrow. Forecasters at the National Hurricane Center say Edward could become a hurricane by then. Nobel Prize-winning Russian author Alexander Solzhenitsyn is dead of heart failure at age 89. Solzhenitsyn's books chronicled the horrors of dictator Joseph Stalin's gulag. He spent 20 years in exile and was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1970. The Italian government has deployed thousands of soldiers on the streets of its major cities in a bid to beat crime. Tourist sites in Rome, Milan, and Naples will benefit from the increased security. Green Bay quarterback Aaron Rodgers is telling Brett Favre to bring it on. Favre is back with the Packers, who couldn't work out a deal to keep him in retirement.
Oh my, that's going to be a fun training camp this summer.
Hope they play nicely. Rodgers says he's ready for a dogfight, so somehow I doubt it, over the starting quarterback position. And we're 4 days away from the Summer Olympic Games, or as Adora likes to call it, O-Day. This little number is called Welcome to Beijing. It's not the official anthem. The official anthem for the Summer Olympics is under wraps right now. I'll see if I can bust those wraps before the end of this week.
Wasn't that some of the sound you gave us last week, a little peek preview of the opening?
This is different.
No. But that was... Okay, never mind. Go ahead.
You want to argue?
Is Brett Favre going to be at the Olympics? Do you think Brett's going to be there?
Not that I know. I think he might be a little bit busy. But yeah. Making news today from China, the Pope has blessed the Olympics. There's also been a border raid on China's Asian border and demonstrations in Tiananmen Square. More on that later in the news.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You know, the nation was still reeling from the immediate aftermath of September 11th, when deaths from a new kind of attack produced another national crisis.
We now have a second front on this war against terror here at home. We've been struck, obviously, on September the 11th, and we're being struck again. Anytime anybody puts anthrax in a letter, it's an act of terror.
Anthrax. The first incident in the anthrax scare came into the public eye on October 4th, 2001. Bob Stevens, a photo editor at American Media, was hospitalized for inhalation of the spores. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson told Florida health officials it looked like a standalone incident.
The Centers for Disease Control has just confirmed the diagnosis of anthrax in a patient in a Florida hospital. Based on what we know at this point, it appears that it's an isolated case.
Bob Stevens died the following day. It was the first U.S. case of anthrax in 25 years. The source of anthrax was found. It was located at the Boca Raton offices of American Media, the publisher of National Enquirer. It was not isolated. More anthrax-laced letters were found in the mail, targeting lawmakers and members of the media. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle told reporters that the substance had turned up in his office. Director of Homeland Security Tom Ridge said it was hard to rule out or rule in the September 11th connection.
There is no credible evidence that ties them to Al-Qaeda, but I think circumstantially, presumptively, it's a terrorist act, tying it specifically to Al-Qaeda and the events around September 11th. May be the result of the intense investigation that's going on by the FBI right now.
Anthrax kept showing up. A CBS and ABC employee tested positive for anthrax poisoning. So did a New Jersey postal worker. Another postal worker from D.C. placed a call to 911, guessing his shortness of breath might be linked to contact with the toxic substance.
My breathing is very, very labored. I don't know if I have been, but I suspect that I might have been exposed to anthrax. Last Saturday morning at work for the Postal Service.
2 days later, the postal worker Thomas Morris was dead. One of his colleagues testified before the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee.
The employees are just very scared. They don't know who might be next or what might happen.
FBI Director Robert Mueller tried to dispel the impression that things were spiraling out of control.
Nothing yet has been ruled out, and investigators continue to follow the evidence wherever it may lead.
By the end of the year, 5 people were dead and 17 ill from anthrax poisoning. In December, President Bush had very little to tell the American people.
We're still looking on that. We've all got different feelings about it. And we're gathering as much information. As soon as we make definitive conclusions, we'll share it with the American people.
A name emerged in August of 2002. The FBI was investigating bioweapons expert Dr. Stephen Hatfill. Here's what he had to say.
I am appalled at the terrible acts of biological terrorism that have caused death, disease, and havoc in this great country starting last fall. But I am just as appalled that my experience, knowledge, dedication, and service relative to defending the United States against biological warfare has been turned against me in connection with the search for the anthrax killer.
Hatfield filed suit. The Justice Department paid him $4.6 million as a settlement. Now the case of Bruce Ivins has raised more questions, but the investigation is continuing.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, August 4th, and Femi Oke has just joined us with the very latest headlines. Femi?
Thanks, Adore. 12 minutes to the hour. The U.S. military said two American soldiers were killed and one was wounded by a roadside bomb in Baghdad on Monday, while Iraqi officials reported that at least nine Iraqis died in a separate series of bombings. Residents along the Gulf of Mexico are battening down the hatches for the second time in less than a month as Tropical Storm Edward churns west along the Gulf. Edward could be near hurricane strength when it hits somewhere along Texas or southwest Louisiana tomorrow. The 17th International AIDS Conference is underway in Mexico City. It's drawn around 20,000 scientists, government officials, and activists. Former President Bill Clinton is one of the conference speakers. The themes for this year's gathering include fighting prejudice and using protection against the deadly virus. Now, Adora has a great phrase that I love when things aren't quite going to plan. She says, whoopsie.
Oopsie.
Oopsie, yeah. I think you could apply this phrase to this news story.
I'm very afraid now what's going on here.
Associated Press have a news story, and often when you read news stories on the wires, there's
The Associated Press?
Yes.
Yeah. Whoopsie.
They have a little link, which is an underlined link, which says, right. You know, go and find more information here. So you click on the underlined link. So there was a story about Elliot Spitzer, the former New York governor, and in that story were two words, underage girls. For more information, go to that next story. Well, when you click on that story, you go to a whole area that you probably wouldn't want to go to.
I'm really scared now.
Underneath whoopsie. Sorry. I mispronounced your mispronunciation. Apologies, I will practice that one. Yahoo has now taken that link out, so it will no longer be a shortcut.
And that's all from just Googling oopsie.
I did not Google that, but I will try that. How do you spell it?
Yeah, that's what you should figure out.
Ooh.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
That's a puzzle for you two to figure out.
Joining me now is Evan Coleman from Washington, D.C. Evan?
Yeah, hello.
In the coverage last week of your film that was played at the Hamdan trial, we ran across this quote or description of you as the Doogie Howser of counterterrorism. Did you happen to hear that?
Yeah, I think that's from several years ago. But yes, I'm familiar with it.
What do you make of that? This...
What am I supposed to make of it? I think, you know, it's unusual to have someone, I suppose as young as I am, that's as into this field as I am. But, I've spent nearly a decade studying this. So, I mean, it's just a function of how old I am and how long I've been studying this.
How old are you?
I'm 29.
Right. Well, you are a public figure, and good answer to that question. If you haven't guessed by now, Evan Coleman is the filmmaker who produced the Al-Qaeda plan, which was used as evidence in the Hamdan trial, which we spoke about a little earlier this morning with one of the lead prosecutors there. Evan Coleman is an international terrorism consultant and was hired by the government to produce a film to play for the military jury. Can you explain what this film, The Al-Qaeda Plan, was supposed to achieve in court?
Yes, of course. Over the past decade and a half, there's been a large volume of information that has been released in the public sphere about Al-Qaeda from various credible sources, both from Al-Qaeda's own lips in the form of video recordings, audio recordings, and communiques. And you also have, you know, again, a vast volume of exhibits that have been submitted in federal court during trials, like the trials of the 98 East Africa Embassy bombers, Zacharias Moussaoui. And these include everything from the sworn testimony of Al-Qaeda operatives to seized Al-Qaeda documents, the very ingredients that would lead one to understand how Al-Qaeda works.
Well, of course, you know, we get that there's an Al-Qaeda, and any of us who saw what happened on September 11th certainly can draw the conclusion that they don't have any sort of, you know, goodwill for the people of the United States.
It's a little more sophisticated than that, though. I think, you know, right now the jurors down in Guantanamo Bay are having to make some very subtle decisions. And, I mean, these are a lot more than deciding whether or not Al-Qaeda is good or bad. It's understanding how the Al-Qaeda network works, how leadership works, how decisions are made, how it functions.
That's a great subject for a documentary, but I guess as evidence in court, does it concern you that nothing in your film specifically connects Hamdan to anything, any of the images, any of the very gruesome depictions that are in your film?
Well, again, I mean, this is not different from what you would find in federal court. The same exhibits were submitted in the case of Zacharias Moussaoui. And much like Mr. Hamdan, again, with the case of Moussaoui, there was nothing directly connecting him with these events other than the fact that he was an Al-Qaeda member. He was accused of perhaps having knowledge of these events, and he did nothing to prevent himself from being used as a key cog in the wheels that turn Al-Qaeda. And I think, again, you know, this is not a simple criminal conspiracy. This is not the same thing as an organized crime family. It's not the same thing, you know, as a narcotics investigation. This is a far-ranging international conspiracy that began, you know, as many as two decades ago, involved hundreds of different people spread around, you know, various places in the world. Yeah. And it's also based in a language and a culture that, you know, to be honest with you, very few Americans are familiar with.
Right. I mean, speaking of that, do you think now that the movie has been played in open court and, you know, you've achieved a certain amount of notoriety, that it might be time to learn Arabic, maybe go to Afghanistan or Pakistan
or familiarize
yourself with the culture?
I have a degree in Islam, and, I mean, I do speak some Arabic. I'm not fluent. In terms of traveling to Pakistan, trying to do this research right now in Pakistan is extremely difficult. Trying to even get into Pakistan right now to do this is extremely difficult. It's actually, to be honest with you, the people you really want to speak with are not necessarily Pakistanis or Afghanis, but they're actually Arab Afghans, because the people that ultimately are the people that populate this movement are foreign fighters. They're not Afghans. They're not really Pakistanis. And that's the subject, really, of most of this testimony, is that in the movie itself. And as far as that's concerned, I mean, I've interviewed these people and I've spoken with them and I've heard their firsthand accounts. But again, I would say that I think the best place to meet some of these people is not really Afghanistan, because you can't really speak openly with people who are being held in cages, and you can't.
Evan, may I interrupt you for just one second?
Ahead.
Just on that point, just in terms of your perspective, though, I mean, myself having spent some time in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq and the Middle East, my perception of some of these same very issues, though obviously not of research like you, is very different. So what do you think, not having experienced just even the geography of these places, meeting the people of these places, how does that impact your analysis if you're a counterterrorism expert?
Right. Well, I'm studying the organization. I'm not necessarily studying the places. I'm not studying the culture here. I mean, I have a degree in Islam, but my background is in studying Al-Qaeda as an organization, and it's not, you know, that's Al-Qaeda is an organization that exists not just in one country or two countries, but in countries around the world. And to be honest with you, you know, I don't think my perspective is all that different from anyone else who studies this. I mean, to be honest,
that's good. I don't want to run out of time here, but what is next for you? Possibly graduate school? Are you going to, you know, work
well,
as a...
I already have a graduate degree. I have a JD, and I've done graduate level work in this subject. I mean, again,
that's fine. No, I'm not trying to impugn your credentials, but what is your, you know, more films?
No, I mean, again, my focus is on researching organizations and interviewing individuals who are behind them, and again, gathering as much open source information as is out there. And it's really, you know, again, it's a search for ultimate truth, and it's a search for gathering, you know, I think it's important to understand that most of this is being told through the organizations themselves and the people that run the organizations.
Nope. Understood. Yeah. And for a 29-year-old, you've certainly had quite a run the last couple of weeks, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Evan Coleman, 29-year-old international terrorism consultant who wrote, produced, and narrated the Al-Qaeda plan, played in open court in the Salim Hamdan trial at Guantanamo Bay. He joined us from Washington, D.C.
John, guess what?
What?
We're always on here at The Takeaway. You can catch up with us on our website as well as Facebook and friend feed.
On today's show, we're remembering Russian author Alexander Solzhenitsyn. We continue watching the Hamdan case in Guantanamo Bay, the historic military trial against Osama bin Laden's former driver. And we're taking a look at the anthrax investigation, foreclosures, and the continuing downturn in the economy.
And today's takeaway is this.
He was, in many ways, a prophet.
That was BBC filmmaker talking about Alexander Solzhenitsyn. You can join the game of Veepstakes 2008 on Facebook. Just look for the 2008 Veepstakes. We asked people about books that changed the world, and here was your answer.
This is Dana Franchito in South Wellfleet, Mass. Wow, I was very shocked to hear this morning that Solzhenitsyn is dead. Important political book in response to your question. Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein, the Canadian author.
That's a good answer. That's very contemporary answer. I would have picked Animal Farm, but if there's any issue that you want to respond to us, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Huckenberry.
Adore you, Doji here.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Okay, here's some arithmetic. Do this in your head. $6.55, that's the minimum wage, times 8 equals $52.40, times 5 equals $262, times 4 equals 1,048, times 12 equals $12,576, minus about $875 in Social Security taxes, and you take home maybe $11,701. That's if you make minimum wage. How are you feeling?
Not good.
Microeconomics, try nanoeconomics. A discussion of the culture of the minimum wage with author Barbara Ehrenreich. It's your take home on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, August 4th. Minimum wage is up, but jobs are down. We'll take a look. Also, security surrounding the Beijing Olympics is tight, but a clash far from the capital is described as the deadliest against Chinese security forces in recent memory. Myth and realities about the Olympics. Do young people really pay the most attention? Budget woes and school districts are jeopardizing college scholarships for student athletes. That's coming up this hour, but first, these headlines.
Good morning, Adora.
And good morning to you, John.
Residents along the Gulf of Mexico are in the crosshairs of tropical weather for the second time in less than a month as tropical storm Edward churns west across the Gulf. Edward could be near hurricane strength when it hits somewhere in Texas or southwest Louisiana tomorrow. Both states are under a hurricane watch. With the Beijing Olympics just days away, 16 police officers have been killed in what China is calling a suspected terrorist attack in the western part of the nation. Chinese state-run media reports two men rammed a dump truck into a group of jogging officers, then tossed explosives into their barracks. President Bush is kicking off a week-long Asian tour that starts in South Korea and will take him to Beijing. He'll be the first president to attend an Olympics on foreign soil.
The 17th International AIDS Conference is underway in Mexico City. It's drawn around 20,000 scientists, government officials, and activists. Former President Bill Clinton is one of the conference speakers. The themes for this year's gathering include fighting prejudice and using protection against the deadly virus.
Russian media report Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has sent condolences upon the death of Nobel Prize-winning author Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Solzhenitsyn's books chronicled the horrors of dictator Joseph Stalin's slave labor camps. Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers says he's ready for a dogfight with Brett Favre over the starting position. Rodgers says he expects to start this season.
I've just been trusting the organization with what they're telling me. And I know at some point I'm going to get my opportunity. Right now, I'm the starter. Until that changes, that's my focus.
Green Bay failed to work out a deal to keep Favre in retirement.
In politics, John McCain starts the day in Pennsylvania and then heads to South Dakota for the annual Sturgis motorcycle rally. Barack Obama unveils his energy plan in Lansing, Michigan today. He'll be in Boston tonight for a fundraiser. Oil's up more than a dollar in Asian trading. It's at $126 a barrel. The Dow closed down nearly 0.5% to 11,362, and the S&P opens at 1260.
Is there too much hype in the Olympics? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. There are myths and fantasies about the Olympics. We want to know what your favorite one is. If you think the Olympics are too hyped, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's right.
Yeah, hyped or not, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. In anticipation of the Olympic Games beginning on Friday in Beijing, Beijing is surrounded by, blanketed by security. But on the western side of the country, state media says today 16 policemen were killed in an attack there. The Chinese news agency said two attackers drove a truck at a group of police in the city of Kashgar and threw explosives. They then hacked the policemen with knives, according to reports. Two people have been arrested. There has been no independent confirmation, but we're joined for the very latest by BBC correspondent Dan Griffiths, who's in Beijing. And Dan, this is exactly what Chinese officials are hoping to avoid.
Absolutely. Of course, China wanting to focus on the Olympics, a crowning achievement, if you like, from the eyes of Chinese politicians on 30 years of economic growth. Instead, we're waking up to reports all day today, really, about these attacks in Xinjiang on the far northwest province of China. And really, what seems to have happened there is that early this morning, local time, around 8 o'clock, two attackers drove up in a lorry. They drove that lorry into a group of police officers who were out doing their morning exercises, their morning keep fit exercises. The attackers then jumped out of that vehicle. They threw grenades that exploded. They hacked at the police with knives. And we understand from the Chinese state news agency that 14 police officers died there at the scene, another two on the way to a hospital. And the Chinese authorities, at least, are calling this a terrorist attack. That is what they have called it. They suspect that it's a terrorist attack, they say. But of course, as you were saying in that intro, we've had no independent confirmation of any of this. This is just coming to us from the Chinese state news agency at the moment.
And Dan, certainly a very sophisticated attack. We'll talk about now the security in the country, but mostly centered mostly in Beijing. Is that not the case, or is security across the entire huge country?
Well, what's very interesting is when you talk about this province of Xinjiang, it is home to around between 7 and 8 million Muslims, and there are tensions between the Muslim community and Han Chinese who have moved in there. And as a result, the Chinese authorities have really upped the security presence there in recent months and years. So there's a very heavy security presence in Xinjiang, and that's why this attack, if confirmed fully, will be highly embarrassing for the Chinese authorities, because of course it questions their whole security apparatus, if you like, and of course that is the last thing they want ahead of the Olympics, because security, they've said, is one of their key concerns. In the past, we've had Chinese officials saying that one of their key worries is what they call a terrorist attack during the Olympics, and yet here you have in the west of the country a clear breach of Chinese security. So I'm sure officials will be looking at this and they will be extremely concerned.
Dan, a quick question about the subject of this attack. I mean, the Uyghurs, who are the Muslim group that are presumed to be behind this, are very obscure on the world stage, it's fair to say. Not so in China. What are they hoping to achieve, do you think, by attempting to disrupt the games?
Well, it's very early to say really who might be behind this. I mean, certainly the Chinese state news agency has hinted at a group known as the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. But that is a movement that the Chinese have claimed in the past have been behind attacks, and they've actually produced very little evidence to back up those claims. And don't forget, of course, that the Uyghurs, that is the name given to the group of ethnic Muslims that live in that region, and we're talking between 7 and 8 million people, and I don't think for a second the Chinese authorities are assuming that the whole ethnic group is involved in anything like this at all. So you have to be very careful when you talk about Xinjiang in that sense, because of course you speak to people there and there clearly is some resentment towards Chinese rule, there's no doubt about that, but making the connection between that on the one hand and then attacks on the other hand is very, very difficult, because as I say, the Chinese authorities come out and say it's Muslim militants, and they've also come out and say, look, that they believe that Muslim militants are plotting to attack the Olympic Games. But when you say to them, well, where's the evidence, show us what you've got, they produce very little evidence indeed. So there may well be a militant threat there, but the reality is that the Chinese are not at the moment producing the evidence for journalists like ourselves to be able to put those things together.
No, and I think you're absolutely right to be very, very cautious. I guess the question for listeners who maybe don't understand what the issue between the Uyghurs is and China, is there any sort of straightforward political mission on the part of the Uyghurs that they want to get from the Chinese that would illuminate, you know, what might change depending on, you know, what happens at the Olympics?
Well, I think what's very interesting about this whole area is that in many ways it borders Central Asia, and the Uyghur people themselves really are ethnically much closer to Central Asia, both in terms of their culture and in terms of their religion, of course, as well, than they are to China. And over the past few years, what we've seen is a growing influx of Han Chinese who've been coming from other parts of China to Xinjiang, often to work. And I think that has led to tensions, because many Muslims who live in the region believe that some of the Han Chinese are given preferential terms. They believe that this influx of Han Chinese is diluting their own culture and their own community. And many are concerned about that. And that is leading to resentment, and it's leading to tensions. And this is the problem that the Chinese government faces today at the moment, that there are these tensions between these two communities, and they're very difficult to resolve.
Let's put it in a much broader context, which is last week a senior Chinese army official was quoted as warning that Islamic separatists, not just the Uyghur, but also Al-Qaeda, Islamic militants from Turkey, given an incident last month where a so-called Turkestan Islamic Party said it had blown up buses in Shanghai, something that the Chinese did deny, but they're listing a whole line of potential threats, and human rights advocates are charging that this is the reason why they've upped security across the country. It's really not just because of the Olympics, but because of crackdowns.
Well, this is a very interesting point, isn't it? And that point you made about the Turkestan Islamic Party was a very interesting one, I think, because China were appearing really to send out very mixed messages. On the one hand, it was talking, as you were saying, about what it perceived was a threat from some sort of Islamic militant group. And, of course, it has talked a lot about what it believes is a threat from Islamic militants based within the country. And yet, when you have these attacks, and a group called the Turkestan Islamic Party comes out and says it was responsible for them, then the Chinese government turns around and says, no, you weren't. So the Chinese government sending out very mixed messages, and of course hardly surprising then that some human rights groups are saying that really the Chinese government is using these comments on Islam, on Muslim militants, to actually clamp down in areas like Xinjiang, where there is some anti-government feeling that really they're using the idea of a possible threat from Muslim from Islamic militants to actually clamp down in areas where there are tensions and where there's unrest.
Well, Dan, set the scene for us. You know, a couple of days away from the actual opening of the Olympics, how's the air there in Beijing?
It's pretty bad today.
Pretty bad today. And people
are
really...
We had 2 days of clear skies, but today it's back to business as usual.
And people are really starting to arrive. I saw some pictures at the airport. I mean, the place is going to begin filling up. Are you noticing that?
Yes, I mean, you are certainly around the Olympic venues. Not so much in Beijing away from the Olympic venues, but you certainly are around the Olympic venues. And I think what's so interesting about this whole issue of air pollution is, of course, that, you know, the Chinese government is used to controlling this country. It's used to having everything pretty much its own way.
But Mother Nature is another matter there. But more importantly, are the buildings ready to go? Are the facilities ready to go when these athletes are going to be wanting to start their competitions?
They appear to be. I've been up and down to these Olympic venues quite a few times now, and it does appear that all the venues are pretty much ready to go. I must say they are putting a few finishing touches to some of the gardens around the Olympic venues. I've seen gardeners being deployed, literally tens of gardeners in different areas being deployed, putting
flowers
out here, there, and everywhere.
Dan Griffiths, we know that flowers are so important when it comes to the Olympics. Thanks for joining us.
The Olympic orchid team.
Dan Griffiths, BBC correspondent in Beijing, and boy, he was filling us in on a whole lot happening in China.
You know, I've decided I'm just going to chill out. You know, there's so many grenades exploding behind the scenes here that we don't want to even let our listeners in on that.
Yeah, here at the takeaway,
yes.
Or here in the world?
Just here at the takeaway. So I'm going to just chill out and invite our listeners, by the way, to contact us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, because we're talking about the Olympics. There's a whole zillion of memories associated with the Olympics. There's Olympic mythology. There are fabulous performances. There are times that you were, you know, completely on the edge of your seat. And
Nadia
maybe,
Comaneci.
There's one.
When I was a
there's
very
one.
Young girl,
that's
I'll never
right.
forget
that's
her
right.
getting all those tens, perfect tens.
You bear a striking resemblance to Nadia, I think.
That's me, Nadia.
That's right. You can still wear those spandex outfits even after all
okay,
these years.
Okay, I think we'll stop there.
Yes, in any case, you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your favorite performance. Do you think the Olympics are too hyped or not hyped enough, or do you really enjoy this Olympic season every 4 years? Also, we're talking about political books. Alexander Solzhenitsyn died at age 89 yesterday. Certainly his books and his voice confronting the Soviet Union changed the world. What other books do you think qualify as world changers, earth shakers?
It finally came to me.
Winnie the Pooh?
I'm not being disingenuous.
Change the world.
Change the way people think.
About?
Children. Humanity.
Okay. All right. Hey, and certainly helped Disney's branding when, you know, Disney owns Winnie the Pooh.
Such a sin.
All right. In any case, you know, we're going to shift now to politics. Andrea Bernstein, a great big never mind, eh?
You could say that.
Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway's political director, commenting and reacting to the revelation this morning that Barack Obama is now urging that delegates from Michigan and Florida be fully seated at the Democratic National Convention in Denver after a fight with Hillary Clinton that took weeks and weeks and weeks, that they not be seated at all. They are actually, they have half a vote now until they change the rules. Andrea, what does this mean?
Nothing. No, actually, it means that the Democrats really do want to win Michigan and Florida. It doesn't mean anything procedurally. It means Barack Obama will still be the nominee for the Democratic Party. But it's a nod to the Democratic parties of Michigan and Florida saying you are extremely important in the general election. We want you. Now, I mean, the interesting thing was is that if you sort of rewind the tape pre that big May 31st confab in the Washington Marriott Hotel where everybody was feeling very tense. Even then, if you ran the numbers, it looked very unlikely that Hillary Clinton could be the Democratic Party nominee, with getting everything she wanted, full seating of Michigan and Florida delegations. But there was a real unease at the top levels of the Obama campaign that if they gave in, they would A, look weak, and B, that Hillary Clinton was going to pull something out of their hat that was going to completely upset the apple cart. So now in July, in the week sort of probably when
But
people
even
are...
back then, though, Andrea, they were not as dogmatic, at least not publicly. The way they spin it was, of course, they wanted the Michigan and Florida delegates to have their place, just not be counted in the primary process. So they were wedging back then, even.
Right. Well, you would go and have half a vote. So practically, that means, you know, not much. What conventions really want is to go to these, what delegates really want is to go to the conventions. We're going to get to go to the convention even with that. But going forward, the Democratic Party really needs Florida and especially Michigan. I mean, there are scenarios that some Barack Obama's advisors have spun out to me, which they can win without Florida. There aren't any that I've seen where they win without Michigan. So they want those states. They want those people. They want them to feel fully a part of the party. And they feel that sort of, you know, having had these 2 months in limbo as half a person, the Democratic delegates of Michigan and Florida, that was punishment enough, and now they will go forward and be full participants in the convention in Denver later this month.
Well, but Andrea, how does this work politically? I mean, are people in Michigan going to go, oh, wow, we're full delegates, and there's going to be some sort of wave of support for Barack Obama either in Michigan or in Florida? How does this procedural change at the convention affect the broad sense of Barack Obama's standing with the electorate in both of those states?
Well, it may sound silly, but delegates are political activists. They're the kinds of people to whom these things matter. So, yes, I'm sure that they feel better going into Denver as full delegates and coming out and organizing in the fall, which is what the Obama campaign really needs them to do.
I see. So it's a matter of engaging the base at the convention and sending them out to do the work in the actual states. I see.
Exactly.
Any sort of sense of a media strategy in Florida and Michigan that would accompany this interesting revelation?
I haven't heard any inklings yet, and my sense from Obama is, especially in Florida, he has so much work to do because big Jewish Democratic community, they've been subject to a big whispering campaign. New York's mayor, Michael Bloomberg, already went down to Boca to denounce the whispering campaign and say we as Jews should reject this, which is very interesting because he hardly ever points out that he's a Jew. But because there was no primary campaign, there was a lot of room for those misinformation campaigns to step in. And it is something that Obama clearly has to combat for the general election.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we should have you back to talk about the significance of misinformation in this very unprecedented political year and in that, you know, pivotal state of Florida. Andrea Bernstein, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Andrea Bernstein is, of course, the Takeaway's political director. And now with headlines, Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. 28 minutes past the hour. Tropical Storm Eduard is picking up speed along the Texas Gulf Coast, and residents of Texas and southwest Louisiana are battening down the hatches. Eduard could be near hurricane strength when it hits land in Texas or Louisiana tomorrow. About 20,000 scientists, government officials and activists are in Mexico City for a six-day global conference on AIDS. Former President Bill Clinton will be one of the conference speakers. The themes for this year's gathering include fighting prejudice and using protection against the deadly virus. Evidence gathered by FBI investigators against biodefense researcher Bruce Ivins was largely circumstantial. That's according to the New York Times. A grand jury in Washington planned to hear several more weeks of testimony. And a person who has been briefed on the investigation, that's what they told the Times. Ivins committed suicide on Friday before he could be indicted for murder in the 2001 anthrax attacks. And finally, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, says that some people view the blessing of same-sex couples or ordination of gay clergy as simply a human rights issue.
One complication in discussing all this is the assumption readily made that the blessing of a same-sex union and or the ordination of someone in an active same-sex relationship is simply a matter of human rights.
Why would the Archbishop be talking about that? Well, after their annual meeting, the Anglican Church from around the world have decided that they won't actually ordain any more gay bishops.
Thanks, Tommy.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, Monday, August 4th, and the Olympics begins on Friday. That's 8:08 at 8 p.m. Supposed to mean good luck there in Beijing. And after years of the buildup, the $1 million that has been spent, the nationalism and athletics and finance and politics and personality and strategic marketing, all those issues are going to be on a global stage. Trip Mickle from Biz Sports Business Journal joins us now, and he says some of it's reality and some of it's hype. Good morning there, Trip.
Good morning.
Okay, you say there are just 8 questions about the Olympics that we should take a look at, and some of them are straight myth and some of them are straight reality, and that we always tend to get them mixed up. Hit me with one of them.
Well, one of the ones that we took a look at and you hear about often in the Olympic world is the fact that the Olympics are less relevant to young people now than they used to be. And we really came down on the fact that this is a reality. The Olympics television audiences in the U.S. is aging. The average age of viewers rose from 38 years old to 47 years old between 1992 and 2004. And part of the reason for that rise is fewer young people are watching. At the same time, over the last 7 years, ESPN Sports Poll shows a 17% drop in the number of teenagers who consider themselves fans of the Olympics. And this is all a concern for the International Olympic Committee because there's a worry that they may lose a generation, and that could hurt sponsorship rights and TV rights, all the revenue streams that kind of make the Olympics go.
So they just don't care about them? Are they busy doing other things like spending time online, spending time with video games, because we know they're not exercising? So is it just that combination of being distracted by other things and fewer kids being involved in athletics in the way that they used to?
I think it's a mix of those factors. Certainly participation plays a role, but also you have to look at, you know, where the games have been broadcast from over the last several years, and really it's been since 1996 that we've had an Olympics in a U.S. time zone, actually 2002 as well. And when you don't have the Olympics in the U.S. time zone, you're generally dealing with a delayed television feed, and young people this day and age can go online and find out results, and therefore, why are they incentivized to tune in later on?
Okay, let's look at number 2. More women follow the Olympics than any other sports, and I'd say that's true. Is it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Next week, NBC will kind of turn Oxygen, which is a women's cable channel, into the unofficial home of the gymnastics, and they can put a ton of other sports on there. 71% of U.S. women are interested in the Olympics, and that compares to 61% interest in the NFL. And you see a lot of this in Olympic marketing as well. Tyson is doing an entire Olympic-themed gold medal mom contest this summer, and there's several other sponsors who are doing similar women-specific programs.
Why is this?
You know,
is it gymnastics?
Obviously, you have sports that appeal to women, gymnastics, equestrian. You don't see those often on a global stage except during the Olympics. And then also you have, you know, NBC, which has kind of figured out this way to tell, you know, stories that kind of exhibit, you know, overcoming obstacles. And I think
they give us the personality story. What they've done is they've let us get to know some of these athletes who are participating in the games. Let's go on to number 3 because we certainly want to move through these. 82% of Americans are fans of the U.S. Olympic team. I would say that's a myth based on what you've already told us.
Yeah, it's kind of fact and fiction. It's funny. I mean, who's really going to say they don't support Team USA? Independent research really shows that the number's about 70%. That 82% number comes from internal research by the U.S. Olympic Committee. So it's a high number regardless of how you look at it. 70% and 82% are both real high, but it's not quite 82%.
Global Olympics sponsorship is not worth the cost.
Joe Nocera wrote an article about this recently in the New York Times, and it's an idea that's been out there, and sponsoring the Olympics has gotten very expensive. The 12 highest level sponsors will spend $72 million over 4 years just to be associated with the five rings, and they'll have to spend an additional $300 million or more to promote that sponsorship, you know, whether that's in commercials or promotions, you know. But sponsors say it's worth it. Visa is kind of the best example why. The company went from being number three in the credit card category in the mid-1980s to number one with its kind of its Olympic campaign before
so it's
the Calgary
worse,
game.
Yeah, it's worth their investment bucks. Okay, we got three quick ones. The Olympics provide an economic boost to their host cities. Myth or reality?
This is a reality. You know, we saw a story the other week about Athens questioning the $15 billion cost of the Olympics. But when you look at the infrastructure development, the fact that they put in a sidewalk that they'd wanted to build for 150 years, the tourism benefits, et cetera, you really see the economic payoff in this. And PricewaterhouseCoopers has done a study on that.
But the bottom line here, though, Tripp, is that Americans still do care about the Olympics. They think it's important, and they support their athletes, our athletes.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, you know what? Thanks for joining us, Tripp Mickle.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.
Tripp Mickle is a writer for Sports Business Journal, talking to us, Femi, about the Olympics. And Femi Oke has just joined us because she has the latest headlines for you.
I'm just thinking I'm going to be in trouble next week because the time difference between East Coast and Beijing is 12 hours difference. It's going to be really hard to actually follow the Olympics over the next couple of weeks. I'll do my best. Meanwhile, the time is coming up to 20 minutes to the hour. The US military said that two American soldiers were killed and one was wounded by a roadside bomb in Baghdad on Monday, while Iraqi officials reported that at least 9 Iraqis died in a separate series of bombings. Residents along the Gulf of Mexico are battening down the hatches for the second time in less than a month as Tropical Storm Edward gains speed over the Gulf. Edward could be near hurricane strength when it hits along the Texas or Louisiana coastline tomorrow. The 17th International AIDS Conference is underway in Mexico City. It's drawn around 20,000 scientists, government officials, and activists. Former President Bill Clinton is one of the conference speakers, and the themes for this year's gathering include fighting prejudice and using protection against the deadly virus.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Russian author and dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn died yesterday from heart failure. The 89-year-old author was the literary voice to chronicle the horrors of the Stalinist prison system, the Gulag.
The hammer banged reveille on the rail outside Camp HQ at 5 o'clock as always. Time to get up. The ragged noise was muffled by ice 2 fingers thick on the windows and soon died away. Too cold for the warder to go on hammering.
It's a BBC reading from Solzhenitsyn's first novel, A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Solzhenitsyn always thought of himself in the tradition of other titans of Russian literature. While others focused on his role as a dissident speaking to the West, Solzhenitsyn was a Russian voice speaking to the Russian people.
I can't say that I wrote my books in order to open the eyes of the West to what had been going on in the East. Above all, I wrote all my books for the benefit of my own people, for the Russians, because we ourselves don't know our own history.
He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1970, something he did not collect in person in Stockholm. He was afraid to leave his country for fear he couldn't return. By 1974, that was no longer a fear. It was reality. The KGB found a manuscript for the first part of his monumental work, The Gulag Archipelago. He was deported to West Germany in February of that year, and eventually he and his family moved to America, Cavendish, Vermont, in 1976. But he was not ever of America. Here's biographer Michael Scammell speaking of Solzhenitsyn's isolation in the free America.
The joke went that when he moved to Vermont, he built his own small gulag around himself. For instance, he upset many neighbors by building a fence around his property. He lived with his family, spoke and wrote Russian all the time, every day, listened to the BBC, particularly to the BBC's Russian service. So he kept, I think, first Switzerland, where he lived, and then America at a certain distance.
Solzhenitsyn never spoke fluent English in the 2 decades he lived here, but he was an irresistible darling of the Western world embroiled in the Cold War. But when the Cold War ended, the country that once persecuted him welcomed him back with open, warm arms in that tradition of Soviet love of Russian love of literature. In 1990, his Soviet citizenship was restored, and in 1994, he made plans to move back. Here he speaks with his son Stephen translating.
I go to Russia overfilled with thoughts and feelings. Both in my heart and in my head.
And later that year, he was greeted with cheers and applause by the people of Vladivostok.
I never doubted that communism was doomed to collapse, but I was always afraid of how Russia would emerge from that communism and at what price. I know I am coming back to a worn-out, discouraged, shell-shocked, unrecognizably changed Russia, which is wandering about in search of itself.
Words that might have been used to describe Solzhenitsyn's legacy inside the country that had welcomed him back. Even as he returned, he remained a polarizing figure. His critics say that his more recent works confirmed his anti-Semitism and his theory of Russian supremacy to other nations. He criticized the excesses of the new Russian government and claimed it was really not democracy. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, author, exiled and then returned to Russia, always a Russian. He lived to be 89 years old and died yesterday.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's time for the latest headlines from Femi. Okay, Femi?
Thanks, Adore. Coming up to 12 minutes to the hour. The U.S. military says that two American soldiers have been killed and another wounded by a roadside bomb in Baghdad. Iraqi officials report that at least nine Iraqis died in separate series of bombings. Tropical storm Edward is churning west through the Gulf of Mexico. It's expected to make landfall tomorrow. Forecasters at the National Hurricane Center say Edward could become a hurricane by then. A troubled Chinese border province in Central Asia is the scene of an attack that killed 16 policemen. The state-run Xinhua news agency said that local police called it a suspected terrorist attack. And the New York Times is reporting that the biodefense researcher Bruce Ivins, the evidence that was collected against him was largely circumstantial. The former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle says that he's very wary about the FBI's handling of the anthrax investigation.
From the very beginning, I've had real concerns about the quality of the investigation, given the fact that they already paid somebody else $5 million for the mistakes they must have made, gives you some indication of the overall caliber and quality of the investigation, and I'm hopeful that someday soon we'll have the answers we deserve.
Bruce Ivins committed suicide on Friday before he could be indicted for murder in the 2001 anthrax attacks. That's a quick look at the main stories from this morning.
Many thanks, Femi. And, of course, we've been covering all of the economic developments in the past days and weeks as things get tough in the economy. It's getting even tougher now for many school districts who are facing decisions as revenues drop in this very tough economy. For many, it may mean cutting sports, perhaps arts, perhaps music programs, perhaps other programs. In Mount Vernon, New York, after two failed budget proposals, many sports have been cut. Joining me here in the studios in New York is Sean Harris. And Sean, you're at Mount Vernon High School. Going to be playing any football this year?
No, not football, basketball.
Basketball this year?
Yeah, I'm a senior in basketball. We're fundraising. We have to raise $1.1 million. The deadline is August 10th. If we don't have the money...
6 days from now.
Yeah, 6 days. We have to raise $1.1 million. We're doing fundraisers, like we're going around the city, stopping cars at lights, asking for any spare change they want to save our sports or anything. They could write a $100 check and send it in. We're just trying to do anything so we can have sports.
How did you find out about this? You were expecting to go back to school. You're a senior. You're on the varsity basketball team.
I didn't know about it till about early July. When I first heard about it, I didn't really think nothing of it. But I heard that later in the stage, I heard that it was really serious, and we had a chance of not having sports. But yeah, it's a serious deal.
So they've cut all sports, not just basketball.
All sports, all 22 teams, boys and girls, is cut.
800 students it affects, right?
Yeah.
and many of them your friends. I mean, what are you telling each other? I mean,
we just try and do anything we can to raise money. Most of my friends are seniors just like me. This is our chance to get scholarships for college and everything. If we don't have sports, then I don't know what we could do.
Your coach told us that playing basketball really motivated you to work harder in school and play harder on the court. And you really, he thought that you would have a good chance of getting some kind of basketball scholarship to a college. And now what?
Yeah, my coach, since I've joined the basketball team, that's motivated me to work harder in class and on the court, even in the weight room. It taught me how to have determination. And without sports, I don't know, really don't know what I'm going to do.
Well, Sean, how do you answer the argument, well, hey, sports are you know, a fringe thing, they're extracurricular, it's probably good that you're going to have more time to focus on academics. What do you say to people who say, you know, it's the main thing is academics?
Yeah, the main thing is academics, but sports teaches you more than just shooting a basketball into a hoop or anything like that. With sports, it teaches you how to be on time, stuff like that, to prioritize.
Discipline.
Yeah, discipline, basically. For people like that...
yeah, that 22-second shot clock, you know, when that reaches zero, you can't say, ooh, just a minute, I was late there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how's tell us about this fundraising. How's it going?
About 2 weeks ago, during the weekend, we went to different places, a Target in Mount Vernon, and we went to a Duane Reade in Mount Vernon, and we stopped at the major lights and the stoplights.
Are you close to your $1.1 million?
I'm not sure where we are now, but we on 2 days on the weekends we raised I think $19,000 in just 2 days, and I know a guy who a director of movies, he donated $25,000.
Wow!
Just alone.
Well, Sean Harris, we're going to wish you good luck on that.
Thank you.
And you got to have a very busy 6 days as you march towards that August 10th deadline for yes. $1.1 million that they need to raise at Mount Vernon High School in order to play basketball this year.
Keep practicing, Sean. The scouts will be watching.
Thanks.
Take care.
All right. Boy, that's tough. That is very tough. Now we're going to shift to war, controversial elections, civil rights, also tough issues. And they're all issues on the table in our 9/11 world, all issues on the table back in the late 60s. It may seem like an odd comparison, but it's really not. Because Brown University professor Mark Tribe, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Now you're, as I said, at Brown University in Rhode Island. Now you noticed something that was amiss on campus given this very same list of issues today versus in the 60s. What is that?
Yeah, well, when I first started teaching at Brown in 2005, I was surprised at how little protest there was on campus. 2 years into the war in Iraq, the campus was really quiet. And I started to talk with students, and I realized pretty quickly that it wasn't so much that they were apathetic. I think they really cared deeply about what was going on in Iraq and also at home, but they felt that resistance was futile in a way. After their experiences, particularly protesting the war before it started in 2003, when hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets. And for many of them also, their first experience of American politics was the 2004 election cycle. So many of them were pretty disillusioned and turned more towards public service.
And that was something clearly not the case in the 60s, where people were feeling pretty empowered, in fact, very empowered. So basically what you've done is you've started this art project where you are helped to stage speeches from figures of the civil rights and Vietnam War era in the same places where their words were originally spoken. Let's listen to a bit of a 1969 speech by Angela Davis that was delivered over the weekend, I believe, in West Oakland, California.
It is becoming evident that the terror in society is no longer just isolated instances of police brutality here and there, but the terror of society is becoming an everyday instrument of the institutions of this country. The head of the National Guard said it outright. It's in the courts. There is terror in the courts. That judge, whose name is Hoffman, proves that he is going to take the terror of society and bring it into the courts. He is going to use what is supposed to be a court of law, justice, equality, whatever you want to call it, and use it to mete out all of these fascist acts of repression.
Professor Tribe?
Yeah.
And you're hoping that by bringing these speeches forth that it's going to encourage discussion, debate?
Yeah. First, it's just amazing to think that she gave that speech when she was 25 years old. And it's,
I mean,
truly,
it's not like it, she could have given it yesterday, actually.
They do sound amazingly relevant today. And, I suppose on the one hand, I want to stimulate discussion. I'm interested in taking these speeches, you know, out of the archives where they are gathering dust in some cases, and reanimate them and insert them into contemporary political discourse and raise the question, you know, what is the role of protest today? How can protest be effective?
Let's listen to just a bit of a Cesar Chavez speech. This is from 1971.
For the poor, it's a terrible irony that in order to rise up out of their misery, they have to go and kill other poor people. But what have we done to show an alternate way? Talk is cheap. Our children know it.
Again, Professor, words that could easily be spoken by someone today.
Yeah, the Chavez speech, like the others, draws connections between domestic issues.
Mm-hmm.
In his case, he was really concerned with Chicano civil rights and the labor movement and what was going on abroad then.
And Professor Tribe, we're going to have to leave it there. We thank you so much for your time, and folks can be looking out for these speeches all over the country this summer. Mark Tribe, Assistant Professor of Modern Culture and Media at Brown University.
And he's working with Creative Time, which is a great arts organization, and his website is the Port Huron Project, which, of course, Port Huron being the site of an important inauguration of a movement against the war and, helping poverty.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.